How you organize your entrepreneurial firm will have huge influences on how successful you are. Can you articulate the right way to design an effective organization? Peter Klein is here today to help us.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute to apply the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free resources and comprehensive show notes, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Today on Economics for Entrepreneurs, we're talking about organizing the entrepreneurial firm. It's a part of your business knowledge where Austrian economics can bring you a unique and valuable perspective that you might not get anywhere else. The subject of organization has spawned a lot of business school courses and a lot of consulting revenues. My bookshelves are full of books about organizational design and organizational strategy, full of diagrams and processes and structures and how to do it checklists. The consultants always know how to do it, and they're happy to tell you once the engagement fee is banked. They have frameworks, guidelines, methods, and rules for you to follow. Austrians think differently. Our approach is not static, but dynamic. An organization is not a structure, it's a process, one that's always adapting to the market. In fact, the concept of organization might be better thought of as the entrepreneur's business model, how to combine assets and people into a collaboration that will create the future value the entrepreneur has imagined, and do so in an efficiently dynamic way to maximize the return on the entrepreneur's investment. So there's no fixed way to do organization, but there are good ways to think about it. Austrian economics helps you think about organization in the right way. First, we always focus on the purpose, which is to create customer value. That's the purpose of everything entrepreneurs do. An organization design is no exception. Organization must elevate those elements that deliver customer value and eliminate those that get in the way. The firm assembles assets and resources that are capable of delivering customer value: physical capital, intellectual capital, human capital, technology, knowledge, methods, processes, operational resources, skills, competencies, and even culture. Organization must facilitate them all working together in value creation with a minimum of waste and non-value creating overhead, which we identified in an earlier episode as transaction costs. But organization is not just eliminating wasteful transaction costs. It must also enable the dynamism of the growing adapting firm. In the value creation business, the customer is always changing. So the market is changing, and competitors and channels are changing. Your firm must be able to change with the market and innovate faster and better than competitors. Organization must enable this agility and never get in the way. Boxes and lines on a chart are not going to help. Going deeper than those boxes and lines, then, entrepreneurs must consider how much delegation of entrepreneurial judgment they'll give to others in their firm. With too little, the firm may miss some opportunities that the agile specialist knowledge and skills of employees could capture. With too much employee discretion, they might tend in the direction of experiments that don't pay off and squander your entrepreneurial capital. So what is organization exactly? There are some good examples available to us of alternative ways to think differently. Tony Hsieh of Zappos famously declared his company to be a customer service firm that just happens to make shoes. That declaration puts a totally different spin on organization. How can it support the customer as its sole rationale? Similarly, Amazon has revolutionized the internal budgeting process by enabling resources to flow where the consumer activity is. The more customer activity, the more the dollars and resources are assigned. This is truly customer sovereignty in practice. The customer sets the budget. That's very proto-Austrian. Today we have Peter Klein back with us. A couple of weeks ago, Professor Klein helped us understand transaction costs, which are a kind of sand in the works of organizations. Today, we'll look at the positive side of organization, enabling the creation of consumer value and achieving the vision of the entrepreneur. Peter, hello.
Hi, Hunter. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Peter, in your judgment-based view of entrepreneurship, you show how economics gives a clear indication of how to think about the question of organization of the firm. What considerations are relevant, what kinds of principles entrepreneurs might invoke when they're thinking about organizational design. So that's our subject for today, and I'm going to start with a quote from your book, Organizing Entrepreneurial Judgment, and it's this: firms exist as manifestations of entrepreneurial judgment. To realize their visions, entrepreneurs must take possession of resources, and in a world of uncertainty, they're continually combining and recombining these resources. So those sound like tangible resources, but you also say the entrepreneur has to create a nested hierarchy of judgment. So there we're talking about people. So let's use that as our starting point, that the entrepreneur approaches the question of organization with this challenge. How can he or she deploy resources, both physical and human, in the best way to achieve their vision, exercise their judgment, and embrace that inevitable necessity to make adjustments, or as they say in Silicon Valley, pivots?
Right.
So where do you suggest they start? Let's think about them starting on this question of organizational design.
Yeah, well, part of the reason we titled the book Organizing Entrepreneurial Judgment was to get people in the entrepreneurship, in entrepreneurship discussions, to think a little bit more about issues of organization and structure and design. And I think those of us who think about entrepreneurship tend to focus more on the ideas, right? I've got a fantastic idea for a product or service. I've got a unique kind of business model or value proposition in mind. And all of that, of course, is extremely important. And it's fantastic that we have idea men and idea women in our economy. But I think there's a tendency sometimes in discussions about entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship to think that once you have this terrific idea or value proposition, the rest kind of takes care of itself. And one of the themes we've tried to emphasize in our book, and you and I have discussed this on multiple occasions, is that it is, you know, having a great idea is not enough. There's the execution of the idea that is critical, right? What we as individual actors, thinkers, what we believe is going to revolutionize the world, you know, may or may not work in practice. We ultimately have to test our theories. We have to subject our conjectures, our beliefs, our hopes and dreams to some kind of a market test, right? Austrian economics is all about the market and the importance of the market and the notion of consumer sovereignty. And so no matter how terrific I think my new product is, if consumers don't find it appealing, if they don't feel like the value they receive from it is greater than what they have to pay to get it, my great idea is never going to be anything more than an idea in my head. So how does the entrepreneur get from this terrific idea, or what the entrepreneur believes is a terrific idea, to something that actually creates value in the marketplace? Well, that's, again, all about execution. And how do you execute? Well, you've got to assemble resources that you can transform from one thing into another thing, and thus, you know, realizing your entrepreneurial vision in the market. Resources include tangible things, raw materials, tools, machines. They include sort of ideas that are legally separable and trade on the market, intellectual property, computer code, documents, and so forth. But they also include people, right? People that you know, people that you have relationships with, people that you can bring onto your team, and you've got to motivate and manage that team. And as you and I discussed, I think in our last conversation, a lot of entrepreneurs don't get real excited about management. They want to think about things and ideas, and they don't want to have to deal with people. But of course, unless you can be a one-person show, you're going to have employees or partners or collaborators. And of course, you have to think about your customers. So managing those resources, both physical resources, tangible resources, and human resources, is a critical way in which entrepreneurs manifest their entrepreneurial visions. So we want to help people to think about, how do I handle and manage productive resources?
Right. Let me just highlight a couple of words that you used, Peter, and see if we can clarify a little bit. You talked about organization as a structure, which always makes me think of organizational charts with boxes and lines. But you also mentioned that it's a process. We use the word design, and design is a process. But you also say in the book that really organization is the entrepreneur's business model. So which of those do we prefer, structure or process or business model?
I mean, I'm somewhat agnostic on the exact terminology that we use. It sort of depends on context, and in different communities of academics and practitioners and so forth, sometimes different terms are used. But I think the distinction between structure and process is very general and very important, right? You can imagine at one extreme, you know, and this is sort of the traditional 1950s model of scientific management, right? The entrepreneur has a clearly articulated organizational chart, a clearly articulated business model or design with boxes and arrows indicating who is responsible for what and which people report to which other people and who has decision authority over use of these resources and those resources. Right at the other extreme is a kind of casual, bottom-up, kind of figure it out as we go sort of model. And maybe we think of a lot of the Silicon Valley startups of the 70s and 80s, you know, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak in the basement, right? Just kind of making it up as they go without much kind of formal structure. Well, probably all real world ventures and certainly real successful real world ventures, you know, have elements of both formal structure and informal process and pivot and adjustment and so forth. So I don't really look at those as alternatives, but rather as complements. I mean, it's useful to have some idea, at least at the outset, of what the kind of formal business model is. Well, you know, Hunter is the founder, and Hunter is making, you know, 50% of the upfront equity investment, and Hunter is going to be responsible for these things. Peter provides other inputs into the process and has other responsibilities at the outset, but we all recognize that we're going to have to make some adjustments as we go. We're engaging in a little bit of entrepreneurial bricolage, to use the term from art and design, right? I mean, we've got to start with resources and relationships and other assets that are available to us now. They may not be exactly the right ones, but let's make the best out of what we've got. And as we develop the venture, we're going to adjust the business model. We're going to change our mix of resources. We may hire and fire employees or you know, change our partnerships in some way. And we recognize at the beginning that we need to have some flexibility to respond to circumstances as they arise, but we don't want to go into it blindly, of course. So, you know, some people are more attracted to formal structure. Some people are more excited by the idea of the rough and tumble sort of flow of adjusting on the fly. But in reality, all successful ventures involve some kind of a mix of formal structure and informal, incrementalism.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let me interrupt briefly to say that organization is one of the steps on the Austrian entrepreneur's journey. We have 12 steps that we walk you through in order with some detail in the Austrian entrepreneur's journey. Our course, it's available at learn.economicsforentrepreneurs.com. That's learn.economicsforentrepreneurs.com. And now back to our conversation. So it's dynamic and flexible. That is great. In order to have that flexibility of what you mentioned sometimes is recombining assets and resources. You say that the entrepreneur needs to have control. We sometimes think of that as property rights over the resources. And control is exercised in the sense of specifying how the asset is to be deployed.
Right.
And you talk about ownership. You say that ownership's important, but in today's age of interconnection, isn't it possible to have control without ownership, where we can, you know, we can rent the server farm instead of owning it, or we can organize the supply chain in China without owning it? So how does the entrepreneur decide on asset purchase versus rental versus flexible contracting and those kinds of options?
Yeah, these are great questions, Hunter. And I want to be clear in what I mean with words like control and ownership, right? So there's kind of a formal, logical notion of control, and then there's kind of the everyday understanding of that concept. And what I mean by control in this context is the person who sort of ultimately, at the end of the day, if necessary, has the authority and the ability or the right to come in and decide, you know, how something is going to be handled. What it does not mean is a party exercising moment by moment, day to day, effective control of every single decision. I mean, think about an analogy. As human beings, we're all in these kinds of relationships. Think about parenting, for example. I have teenage children at home. Do I tell them, you know, what time to get up in the morning? Do I tell them exactly what time to go to bed? Do I tell them what clothes to put on? Do I tell them, you know, how to spend every moment of every day? Well, no, of course not, right? Part of good parenting, right, is deciding when to intervene and when to sort of step back and allow someone else to make his own decision. Of course, when your children are very small, the parents, you as parents, you make almost all the decisions about what they should do and what they should wear and so forth. You know, if you have a 25-year-old at home and, you know, mom is picking out his clothes every day, well, that's not a healthy situation either, right? So over time, as children grow up, as they mature, parents delegate more day-to-day authority to those children while yet retaining some ultimate decision authority, right? I mean, there are occasions where the parent has to step in, even with teenagers or older kids, and say, "No, I'm sorry, you can't do that. You can't go there. We're not going to do it this way." So, what I think of in a healthy business relationship, right? I mean, just take a mom and pop store. You do have an owner, or maybe a family which owns the assets. To make it simple, let's just assume that there's an owner has 100% of the equity of the mom and pop store. Right, but there's also a store manager. There may be employees. There are other folks who are involved in operating the venture. And a good proprietor is not going to look over everybody's shoulder and direct and manage everybody day to day, moment by moment. Right? That's what we mean when we say someone is a control freak. Being a control freak is not a good thing. Right? So when I say ownership plays an important economic role, I don't mean that the owner should be a control freak. Rather, a wise owner will choose to delegate some and maybe most of the day-to-day decision authority to specialists, right? And in any team, the supervisor or manager of the team is going to want to pick good people who have good skills at doing particular things and put those people in an environment where they can thrive, where they can exercise their own authority, right, to make decisions in the way that is appropriate. And the supervisor or the manager or the owner is responsible for, you know, putting the team together, making changes as needed, maybe coordinating some of the actions among the team members, but otherwise not sort of getting into their face. And so what we mean when we say ownership is important and owners exercise ultimate control over their ventures, we mean that, look, when push comes to shove, when unanticipated circumstances arise, if there's conflict, I mean, somebody's got to have the task of resolving that conflict, and that's the role of control that is associated with ownership. But a wise, prudent owner will, of course, not exercise that control, except in cases where it's really needed and where it leads to things being, produces net gains.
Yes, but they do need to know that that asset or that person or that organization is responsive when they do choose to intervene.
Yeah, that's right. And look, ownership and control, it does affect people's behavior and people's incentives, right? If I'm, if you hire me to come over to your house and to, do some repairs to fix your refrigerator, right? I mean, if I'm an independent contractor, I own my own tools, I have my own truck, yet the refrigerator is owned by you, right? That's going to have some impact in how I approach the task and which tools I use, how I invest and maintain my tools, right? As opposed to, if I'm your butler, I'm your hired hand, and I work for you 24/7, and I'm working with your tools as I try to perform some task. Well, I may not maintain the tools quite as well. I'm going to have different incentives in how I allocate my time and so forth if I'm your employee versus if I'm an independent contractor who owns my own stuff, right? So how these ownership arrangements are specified and whether you do have a diffuse network of independent contractors like an open source, with an open source software platform or people editing a Wikipedia entry, that's a different model of organization from one in which you do have an entrepreneur who does have the kind of ultimate authority over how the resources of the firm will be used.
Yeah. One of the things that you said in the book when you're making that argument is that capital assets nearly always possess undiscovered attributes. And that sounds a little bit scary that I bought something or I rented something that's going to act in a different way than I expected. What can you explain that a little bit to help entrepreneurs think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we mean that in a good way, right? And mostly a good way, that any kind of resources that you have, whether they're tools or machines or computer code or whatever, you acquire those resources. Maybe you buy them. Maybe you rent them. With some specific purpose in mind, right? That I can use that tool to, it's a machine, I can use it to produce the gizmo that I'm going to sell in the marketplace, or it's the code that operates it's the software that allows my business model to be successful. But, you never know that resource or tool may be useful for other tasks that you didn't have in mind, right? As you use the tool, you realize, oh, well, gosh, it not only does that thing well, I can also use it to do this other thing that I hadn't anticipated. I mean, the danger, of course, is that if I have a machine and I have an employee who's using that machine, maybe the employee can discover a clever way to use that machine, that's not in my interest. Think about in the early days of personal computing, as workplaces began to install PCs on employees' desks, and then those PCs began to be connected to the internet. Can my employee use the PC to play, to play solitaire or to be on social media or to be watching, a football match or whatever on company time? Well, that's not something that benefits the company. And when those devices were installed, it was not with the goal to facilitate employee, time wasting. It was designed to make the employee more efficient, right? So obviously you want to, as an owner or a manager, you want to be able to place some limits on how resources might be used by employees in ways that are not consistent with company goals. At the same time, you don't want to constrain the employees too much because they may discover ways to use the software or the PC or the tool in ways you didn't imagine that actually enhance the operation of the business. And part of what we call, delegated judgment, this idea of a nested hierarchy of judgment, is that the supervisor, the owner, the manager wants to empower employees to use their own judgment, right, in ways to figure out, hey, here's something you boss didn't think of that we ought to be doing that will lower our costs, that will increase our revenues, that will make our product better. I discovered a new way to do that using the resources that you gave to me. Well, of course, the owner, the supervisor wants to encourage that kind of behavior. So the technical idea behind the phrase that you used is that a resource can be understood in terms of different properties or attributes that it has, different uses to which it can be put. And those are, you know, in an open-ended universe, we human decision makers, we don't always know all the assets or attributes at the start. We kind of discover them. We create new ones as we go forward, as we use resources. And that's a good thing, right? It means that with our human creativity and ingenuity, we can find even new and better ways to do things, to make things that we hadn't anticipated. We just want to make sure that the organizational structure is consistent with encouraging the productive use of new attributes while discouraging kind of wasteful or opportunistic uses of those attributes.
Yeah. Yes. You mentioned some of that in your book when you're talking about the entrepreneur may not know the full set of actions that are open to his or her employees or appreciate the full range of their special skills. And you say that makes the exercise of authority through direction increasingly inefficient. Now, I'm a fan of a lot of these new organizational forms that are emerging. You mentioned one of them in your book, the Starfish Model, but there are all kinds of other kinds of networked informal organizations. Is there any evidence that those are more innovative or more successful than firms that use older kinds of structural organization practices, or is it not proven?
Right. Yeah. I mean, anecdotally, it certainly seems apparent to many people that kind of looser structures are more important today, or rather, they're central to a more important part of the economy. Right. These kind of obviously information technology and software kinds of products and services. There's no way that you can operate something like that the way you could operate, you know, the steel factory of the 19th century. So there certainly is a greater role for kind of delegation of authority because of new production models and new kinds of goods and services that we're in than was the case before. But I think it's important not to overstate that particular case, right? There's still a role for management or supervision, not in directing employees what to do, as might have been the case, you know, in the old economy, but in kind of setting parameters, or we call it, use the language of designing rules of the game, mm-hmm. right? Telling people, hey, okay, this is how it works. You get to decide all these things. Here's how we're going to evaluate your performance. Within that framework, you go and sort of figure it out. But Hunter, I think it's worth pointing out, there is an old economy or older economy equivalent, right? Think about the sales function in many organizations, even in very traditional kinds of organizations over the last 100 years or so, right? It's quite common for manufacturers to give their, or retailers to give their sales reps a lot of authority, a lot of discretion in deciding mm-hmm. where to go and so forth. You know, but think about sales as a function for which there isn't a lot of highly specialized equipment or machinery or assets for which there are a lot of kind of, you know, potentially undiscovered new attributes. I've got, you know, say it's, you know, clothing or agricultural products. My grandfather was a traveling salesman in the United Kingdom for various kinds of farm-related goods and services. And so, you know, he would get his inventory of a bunch of these products that he would sell. And his employer would, you know, his employer said, well, here, you got use of a company car. Here's the inventory that you've been assigned to sell. You know, you get paid on a commission basis. It's easy for us to monitor how much stuff you've sold, for us to know how much you get paid. But we're not going to tell you where to go and when to go there and how to talk to these farmers. You know, go out and do it. And mm-hmm. of course, my grandfather he'd done it for a long time. He had relationships with all these farmers in these different small towns. They all knew him. It was easy for his employer to say, okay, go on. We'll see you, you know, at the end of the month. Tell us how much you sold and you'll get your commission. We don't need to know exactly where you are and who you're talking to and what techniques and strategies you're using to persuade the buyers to buy. All we need to know is how much did you sell? And we don't need to know all those other things, right? So yeah. On the other hand, maybe in a manufacturing context or for other kinds of functions, where it's more difficult to monitor outputs or to monitor employee contribution to outputs, maybe there supervisors would want to exercise a little bit more control. So even before the days of the internet, you know, there's always this trade-off between delegation and monitoring. And for some functions, you can delegate a lot and the monitoring is very light. Whereas for other functions, you might not want to delegate quite as much and might want to monitor more closely.
Yeah, actually, you could make the argument the internet's going backwards because that salesperson would have to fill in every transaction on the Salesforce CRM now, and artificial intelligence would tell them where to go first and where to go second.
Yeah, you're right. Although maybe the AI could just figure out from your GPS locator, right? Are you going to enough different places? Are you spending too much time at each stop? That's the interesting thing about technology. And you and I discussed this on a previous show, that of course it does facilitate a lot more kind of arm's length delegation, but it also allows for lower monitoring costs, you know, internally. So, I mean, at the end of the day, who knows, maybe with AI and robotics, we'll end up monitoring our employees more closely rather than giving them more latitude.
Yeah, I'm very taken with the Halo Top ice cream model, partly because I enjoy the product, but they built a nine-figure revenue business in a manufacturing industry. You've got to manufacture the ice cream with no central office location, no manufacturing assets. They use co-packers. So essentially a recipe and some packaging design, and as you say, a sales force. So
yeah. Well, if I could just return to one of your earlier questions about, you know, sort of, is it the case that nowadays you really don't have to own as much stuff? You're absolutely right. I mean, the internet has facilitated a kind of very lean business model, right? Where what the entrepreneur owns is essentially the brand, some intellectual property, you know, a little bit of equipment and office space, and maybe has a small number of employees, and then is able to coordinate and contract almost everything else. You know, production can be outsourced, distribution can be outsourced, marketing, finance can be outsourced, and so forth to independent partners who own their own stuff. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, from a societal point of view, what that says to me, it's not that the ownership function it per se is less important. It's that it's distributed in a different way, right? So that packing facility for Halo Top, that's owned by somebody. Mm-hmm. So it's just that owner is using his or her assets on a contract basis to produce a product that's branded for somebody else. And, you know, the truck driver maybe who owns his own truck and contracts to distribute Halo Top to the supermarket, I mean, all the assets are still owned by somebody. It's just that ownership can be spread out in a different way or distributed in a different way throughout the economy than in an older model where ownership of the brand and the intellectual property and the physical infrastructure and the transportation infrastructure, you know, is all the same party.
Yeah, that's a good way to help people think, Peter, I think. How do we distribute ownership? One example that comes to mind, we talked to Ed Plettner on one of our earlier episodes. He owns an e-waste service. So he helps companies to get rid of their digital waste, both the data and the physical machines. And the customer has to be 100% certain that the compliance requirements for e-waste are adhered to. And Ed feels as a result of that, he's got to own the shredding machines and all of the physical plant that makes sure that he can fulfill that promise in a certifiable way. So he wouldn't give up ownership of those particular assets because it's part of his trust.
Right. Yeah, that's a good way to think of it, that there might be some activities or functions that are so core to the business, either they rely on some kind of specialized tacit knowledge that's not generally available out there in the market, or there are, you know, issues of proprietary knowledge or information where the entrepreneur prefers to centralize those functions, whereas, you know, transportation or warehousing or maybe some HR functions are more easily outsourced to specialized providers. And in fact, you know, there are a lot of, like the gentleman that you mentioned, there's a lot of sort of entrepreneurial opportunity, if I can use that language, in providing these intermediary functions for other entrepreneurs, right? And think about companies, you know, like Salesforce, for example, that have become extremely large companies offering, you know, for small ventures to be able to outsource their payroll or outsource some of their accounting functions. Think about specialized transportation and delivery services. Think about even UPS and FedEx, which are, you know, were large companies before the internet, but are even larger now because they allow entrepreneurs, other entrepreneurs, to specialize in their own core functions and not worry about getting a package from place A, you know, point A to point B, because there are specialists on the market, there are other firms on the market who can perform that service. But one of the neat things about economic development and change over time is how, you know, these new kinds of outsourced providers or new providers to whom you can outsource things begin to pop up, right? In the early days of the computer industry, computer firms were doing a lot more. They were internalizing a lot more functions, hardware, software, service and support for their customers and so forth, because they had to, because there wasn't anybody out there from whom you could just purchase these things. But now as the industry has matured, IT entrepreneurs, tech entrepreneurs, they can really focus on the thing that excites them the most, and they can outsource many of the non-core functions because that industry has matured to a point where there are lots of those external parties who are happy to take on those mundane, kind of boring and routinized tasks that the entrepreneur would prefer not to have to deal with.
Right. Let's talk about the similar question regarding people and employees. And the big tool of control is the employment contract. And you mention in your book that the entrepreneur has original judgment, but he or she might want to create what you refer to as proxy entrepreneurs in their employees by delegating certain decision rights. They lose some control, but they get benefits from that. And you introduce a couple of reasonably scary terms: productive entrepreneurship, which is fine, and destructive entrepreneurship, which doesn't sound so good. So let's work our way through that.
Yeah. So we're trying to come up with some terminology that gets at some of these subtle distinctions we've been talking about today. And, you know, maybe these aren't exactly the right terms, but what we have in mind is, again, if you think of that illustration with my grandfather, you know, as a traveling salesman, you know, his employer wants to give him as much independence and latitude and motivation as possible for him to discover new ways to do the job even better, right? So my grandfather would not only go from farm to farm offering these products, he also figured out that if he played a prominent role at some of these agricultural festivals and gatherings and you know, contests that would be held out in the countryside, that would actually allow him to sell more stuff, right? So he participated a lot in, you know, joining all these local societies and being judges at the competition where they judge the best potato or whatever.
Yep.
Not only because that helped his sort of personal brand as a salesperson, it helped him to build relationships, but also he would set up a little stand, a little table, you know, at the festival, at the show, where he would display some of his wares, some of the products that, again, he personally didn't make, but were the products that were made by his employer. Now, the employer let him do those things because the employer realized, hey, well, we never realized that it was a good idea to get our salespeople to show up at these judging competitions. But wow, what a great idea. At the end of the day, that really helps our bottom line, right? So when it's easy to measure the bottom line and easy to measure how much an employee is contributing to that bottom line, you don't want to constrain that employee a lot. You want to say, like to my grandfather, look, use your own judgment in figuring out the best way to sell this stuff. Now, in our book, we had already explained that judgment, meaning these kind of ultimate decisions about how things will be used, is closely tied to ownership. So how do we explain a situation where you're giving an employee who is not an owner of the company a lot of authority to go out and figure stuff out. Well, we came up with this term proxy entrepreneur as a way of saying, well, you know, my grandfather, he wasn't an entrepreneur in the sense that he was the founder or owner of the company. He was just a salaried employee on commission, right? But he was also the kind of go-getter guy who the employer wanted to be out there figuring stuff out. So it's like he's sort of acting as an entrepreneur as a proxy for the actual owner of the company. We called that delegated judgment. So we say, you know, the founder and owners of that company, they hold the sort of original rights, the we call it original judgment, the rights to make these decisions, but they hand a lot of that de facto judgment over to their salespeople, like my grandfather. So he operates, he exercises, you know, something that's kind of like judgment that's derived from the judgment of the owners of the company. So not to go get too much into the weeds on these terms, but all we mean is my grandfather was acting as kind of a proxy for the owners of the company in being creative, in being innovative, in trying out new stuff, in making experiments, and taking advantage of new opportunities as they arise. And that's exactly what, you know, an employee wants. Sorry, what an employer wants that kind of employee to do. The, you know, the so-called destructive entrepreneurship refers to cases where, you know, the company delegates all that authority to the employee and then finds out, well, you know, with some employees or maybe with all employees some of the time, they're using their discretion to cut corners a little bit, to put fewer hours into the job, or to, I don't know, you know, design their customer list or their sales routes in a way that allows them to go sightseeing or go on a vacation or you know, who knows. So there's always the danger that when you own a thing, you own a company, you own a machine, but you hire someone else and ask them to work on this thing for your benefit, and of course for their benefit in terms of pay and so forth, but they're really using your stuff, using their own specialized knowledge and their own specialized expertise to make your company run better. There's always a danger that they may, you know, they may use that authority in a way that really benefits them rather than you. On the margin, a little bit of that, you know, is no big deal. You know, I've been known to take a company pen home or some paper clips in my pocket and use them for purely personal projects, you know, at home. I'm sure my employer is fully aware of that kind of shirking and that kind of skimming or whatever, and doesn't have any problem with it at all. On the other hand, you know, if I'm going on a company trip, that's really just a junket, and it's really just vacation time for me, and I'm pretending that it's a company trip and spending the company's money, well, they're not going to be too happy about that. So, you know, that's a trade-off. That's a margin that the entrepreneur, you know, has got to be looking at pretty closely and always, you know, being aware of whether the right amount of delegation is, whether you're delegating the right amount of decision authority, not too little, but also not too much.
Well, in fact, you give entrepreneurs a tool for doing that, and you call that tool specifying decisions. So it's the decision about constraining or unconstraining, or tight or loose, and so on.
Yeah, that's what right. Right. I think that margin, it depends on the particular depends on the context. It depends on the particular business venture and industry. It depends on the characteristics of that employee. Again, not to overuse the parenting analogy, but with a brand new, green, inexperienced employee, you probably want to specify more of those employees' decisions for him or for her. With a more experienced employee, someone who maybe has more industry or technology specific expertise, and someone who has earned a reputation for reliability and honesty, it's like with an older kid, right? Then you would probably specify fewer decisions and allow for greater delegation. But you might adjust that margin as circumstances change, as economic conditions change, as you learn more about your product, learn more about your customer base, learn more about your business model. Again, what we're saying is, you know, the entrepreneur does not have to be an expert in every technical aspect of the business, But the entrepreneur has to be a good enough judge of other people and, you know, good enough, have a good enough intuitive feel for the business that the entrepreneur can kind of see those red flags. Okay, I've tasked an expert to do these things. I'm not completely comfortable with what I'm hearing from that expert. I don't really have enough, you know, technical knowledge to point out exactly what's making me uncomfortable, but something about it isn't quite right. I need to look at that more closely. Maybe ultimately I need to replace that expert with somebody else.
Yeah. Let me just press you just a step further. Is there a systematic way that the entrepreneur can go about that? So, for example, I could write a consulting book that said, here are the 45 most important specifying decisions, and you know, here's the red light, green light, yellow light way of thinking about them. Or is it, as you imply, I think, just keep experimenting until you get it the way you want it?
Yeah, I mean, it is an experimental process in all cases. But look, if the entrepreneur is also an industry expert, right? If the entrepreneur is, you know, if it's a technical business and the entrepreneur is also an engineer, or the entrepreneur came out of a sales background and this is, retail business, then yeah, that entrepreneur may come with a list of 25 things. I can't tell you what that list is now, right? But mm-hmm. It would include things like, allocation of labor on the job. It would include what kind of payment system do you use? Are you paying people an hourly wage? Are your employees salaried, or are you paying on a commission rate? And what is that commission rate? What kind of reporting do you want your employees to perform? Maybe a lot of it's automated with your ERP system, but maybe it's not. How often do you want them to report? What things do you want them to report? All of those would be on a kind of a list. And again, an entrepreneur who has a lot of technical industry specific knowledge might have a very detailed list, right? That refers to how the machine is used and how often are you servicing the machine and so forth. But an entrepreneur can be very effective without that kind of technical knowledge, right? Simply with some general knowledge about what things to look for in the financial statements and in whatever kind of internal reporting systems are being used, keeping in mind that, you know, the best made plans of mice and men, we know what happened to those, right? So mm-hmm. even with a very detailed list ahead of time, the entrepreneur should be prepared, you know, to pivot, not just, we usually think of pivoting in terms of the product characteristics, right? Or the marketing strategy or whatever. But no, the pivoting may be on this kind of organization and governance level too. Maybe I realize, gosh, this kind of halo top model is really not working for me. We need to internalize some more functions. Or I've been controlling things too tightly. I need to delegate more. I need to have a looser kind of a structure and trust my employees that they're going to know what to do. That's something that the entrepreneur is also going to have to figure out as the venture proceeds.
Yeah. You also mentioned, just to touch on it, that the compensation system is one of the entrepreneur's tools. And if I want my employees to act more entrepreneurially, there are compensation tools to do that, like equity programs and options and those kinds of things. So that's another tool for the entrepreneur, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, I think a lot of course, there are a lot of, you know, administrative tools, planning tools, management techniques that you can, you know, that consultants will recommend and that you can find in Barnes & Noble and so forth. You know, those are some of them, those can be useful. And some of those kinds of specific matrices and so forth can be good planning tools. But, you know, I teach a strategic management course to MBA students, and I always emphasize that those tools should be thought of as kind of very general frameworks, as kind of heuristic tools that may be useful for some decision makers and some, you know, some supervisors in some particular context, and should be used in that way as appropriate. But they're not; they shouldn't be taken as gospel. They should never be so constraining that, you know, if they just don't make sense, they just don't square with the entrepreneur's or the manager's mental model of how the organization is working, then those things should never be followed religiously, where they become a handicap. I mean, some of them are really, the people who are making these matrices and charts are themselves entrepreneurs selling a product. And if they add value, then sure, use them just like any other thing you would buy, any other resource that you would pay for to help your business, but don't regard them as sort of gospel truths.
Yeah. Well, it's time to sum up, I think, Peter, and that's going to be my summary, that there are consultants who make a lot of money selling those organizational designs, and they have lots of rules. I found that rules like the number of direct reports you can have and the distance between the CEO and the factory floor. And as you mentioned, decision rights matrix or matrices, if that's the right word for the plural. Always remember the RACI chart, who's responsible,
oh, yeah.
Who's accountable.
Right.
And those are always fights, I find. So that's not a good tool. So economists like yourself don't make rules. And they suggest to the entrepreneur that organization is a reflection of their vision. It's got to support their value creation. And beyond that, it's entirely flexible in terms of structure of ownership and discretion of employees. And it's a matter of dynamic flexibility in getting that right and being ready to make changes if it's not right. So
yeah,
that would be my summary. You always improve my summaries.
No. I think that summary is terrific. I would just like to add one additional point before we completely wrap up, which we didn't touch on yet, is that the model of financing also has implications for mm-hmm. organization and governance, right? I think, and this is something we emphasize in our book and in some of our follow-up work to the book, that another danger for the entrepreneur is to get into the habit of thinking, well, I've got the idea, I've got the expertise. Well, yeah, of course I need cash. Of course I need some startup capital. I can just get that from the bank. I can get that from some angels or VCs. They're just going to give me money and then leave me alone. Well, obviously that isn't the way it typically works. And how a venture is funded also has implications for the organizational issues that we're talking about, because those external equity investors are not, you know, they're going to want to play they will become part owners of the venture. And if the founder sells some of that equity to outside investors, that's not just cash for free, right? You're also giving up some decision authority. Maybe it's only this kind of residual decision authority, but decision authority nonetheless, that has big implications for how the venture is run. So finance is closely tied to this sort of area as well, and entrepreneurs need to avoid thinking that funders are just rich guys who write you a check. Funders will play a governance role as well. So maintaining this balance between having a model with sort of some structure and some fixed rules, and being able to improvise and make adjustments on the fly. We do that in all aspects of our everyday life, and that's super critical for entrepreneurs as well. So having a great idea, having access to capital, knowing great people, obviously these are necessary for a venture to be successful. But I always urge entrepreneurs, don't ignore or don't minimize the mundane aspects of organization and governance. How are you going to manage that team? Who's going to get to decide what things? How will conflicts be resolved? Who at the end of the day has the right to decide how that machine or tool is going to be used, where this person is going to go or do, where they're not allowed to go or what they're not allowed to do? And, the buck stops here with the founder owner, and you got to be comfortable, having that buck stopping at your desk. And, being the guy or gal who's got to make those tough decisions when push comes to shove.
Yeah, and I think our general advice, which you always provide, about always thinking through all of these trade-offs, all of these next consequences. If I do this, what happens next? And what happens next? And if the environment changes, you mentioned finance. One of the things that is always true in that external financing is, each time you go get more, you lose more control. You're ceding more control at the next financing round every time. So you got to think that through too. Where do I end up in terms of how much control I've given away through several rounds of financing? So think everything through as far into the future as possible, knowing that it's uncertain, but think of possible consequences.
That's right. As the great Yogi Berra put it, you know, predicting, how did he say it? Prediction is hard, especially about the future.
Yeah, exactly. That's, we call that uncertainty, right?
Right.
Yeah. Good. Well, thank you very much, Peter. I hope we've given entrepreneurs something to think about, and there isn't going to be a book of rules that you can refer to, but there is going to be a method of thinking, and that's always what we try to do here at Economics for Entrepreneurs. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Hunter. It's a pleasure as always.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.